LSU White Tiger. After the thrill of my clan initiation, our clan den activities seemed rather mundane. The clan seemed more of a social club than anything else. Occasionally, we printed flyers and distributed them. Usually, we used the piggyback method of distribution. That consisted of getting stacks of free newspaper giveaways and affixing our clan leaflets with a rubber band and then throwing them on the lawns of selected neighborhoods. We also had some cross-lighting ceremonies, usually in St. Bernard or St. Tammany Parish. Cross-lightings were generally referred to as cross-burnings by the media, implying somehow that they were anti-Christian sacrilege. Calling cross-lightings anti-Christian was hypocritical and deceitful, a tactic used by the anti-Christian Jewish-dominated media. Actually, cross-lightings represent an illumination of the cross. For centuries before the advent of electric lights, Christians had been stirred by the beauty of candles arranged in the shape of the cross. The Scottish clans, who also had a strong Christian orientation, used it as a symbol in opposition to tyranny. For us, it was a sacred ceremony and not meant as an intimidation tactic of any kind, but the media portrayed it as a sign of terror. Some whites, usually kids, unfortunately picked up on that symbolism presented by the media, and they would light crosses to show opposition to integration of schools or neighborhoods. I began to drift away from the Klan in the latter part of my senior year in high school. Although I admired James Lindsay and loved the valiant heritage of the Klan, it just seemed to me that the Klan was simply too mired in the past and was not ready to adopt new strategies for victory. Even before I joined the Klan, I had read some of the literature of George Lincoln Rockwell, the leader of the American Nazi Party. Rockwell was an interesting and compelling personality. He was a U.S. Navy fighter pilot who achieved the rank of commander fighting against the Germans during the Second World War. After the war, he became active in the conservative movement, at one time working with William Buckley. Rockwell, while still a conservative, became awakened to a thorough understanding of the race issue, including Jewish supremacism, but felt frustrated that so many conservative leaders refused to say publicly the things that they said privately. He decided on a bold strategy of raising the swastika banner, even with all of its negatives, in order to use its sensationalism to bring attention to the critical issue of Jewish supremacism. He explained it as political jujitsu, or the art of using the overwhelming power of an opponent against himself. Commander Rockwell cultivated the image of a humorous buffoon and as an incredibly radical person in short media sound bites. But when he appeared on talk shows and before college audiences, he presented a reasonable and appealing image. In college speeches, he shocked his audience with Churchill's Illustrated Sunday Herald article on the Jewish leadership of communism, as well as pertinent documents from the National Archives describing the Jewish takeover of Russia. He exposed Jewish supremacy and hypocrisy and the efforts by Jewish groups to suppress the truth. He impressed me with his intelligence and bravery, and I began to correspond with him in the months before an assassin's bullet struck him down. I told him that I was traditionally Southern and intensely proud of both our Southern and American heritage. I let him know that I understood the race and Jewish issues, but that I was also fiercely patriotic and believed in the Constitution and protections of free speech and press. Rockwell replied that his group endorsed a strictly pro-Constitution position and was not totalitarian like the Germans. His effective uses of radical tactics to make people confront the racial truth impressed me. He wrote that, quote, "The white race had to be shocked out of its lethargy and racial suicide," unquote. After his death, I felt torn between the traditional Klan approach and Rockwell's more unconventional methods to break through on the issues. Rockwell's legacy drove me to my later action. When I was 19 years old, during my freshman year in college, William Kunstler, a communist Jewish lawyer, came to speak at Tulane University in the spring of 1970. Kunstler had been the main lawyer for the Chicago Seven defendants, who were charged with rioting at the 1968 Democratic National Convention. He had also been involved with hundreds of black legal actions trying to force destruction of white schools and neighborhoods. One of the things that really disturbed me about Kunstler was that the media seldom mentioned his communist activism and beliefs. Instead, they presented him as a, quote, activist or, quote, civil rights lawyer, never as the communist revolutionary that he admittedly was. I wanted to do something to call attention to his communist pedigree. I heard about his scheduled appearance at Tulane University only a day before the event. My good friend Ray Lehart and Lewis McWilliams asked me if I wanted to do anything, and I thought about it quickly and proposed that we picket him. We made up one large sign reading, "Kunstler is a communist Jew." To add to the drama and prevent the press from ignoring it, I decided to try the Rockwell tactic and use a swastika armband to demonstrate against this communist traitor. We went to the location of a speech at McAllister Auditorium on the Tulane campus and found ourselves greeted by 36 members of the Black Panther Party, all of them wearing berets and black leather jackets. To picket, I would have to walk right through their gauntlet. Only one unarmed Tulane security guard was on hand as Ray and Lewis unwrapped the sign from the shopping bag. I hoisted the provocative sign and started to walk toward the blacks. I knew I was doing a foolish and dangerous thing, but at the same time, I felt exhilarated, for it felt good to stand up and express publicly my opposition to a man whom I felt was a traitor. Kunstler was a man who had stabbed the American fighting man in the back in Vietnam by his support of the Viet Cong. As I stepped out on the sidewalk, it seemed everyone stood frozen for a moment. The white students were looking on in disbelief, and the Black Panthers couldn't believe that a lone white teenager would dare stand up to them. Within moments, TV and newspaper cameramen descended on me, and the security guard powered up his radio with desperate pleas for backup officers. Each time I walked past the black gauntlet, their obscenities and threats grew louder. Four more security guards arrived, and the police car with lights flashing roared up on the sidewalk in front of the auditorium. A campus security guard stopped me, asked if I was a student, and then said I had no right to be on campus. I responded that I had a right to be there because this was a public event at a university that receives some public funds. Within 20 minutes, a half dozen more police cars showed up, and about 10 police officers were present while I walked just a few feet from the Black Beret revolutionaries. Ray and Lewis also took the sign for a round or two, and then we left. Our point made. My father was furious when he found out what I'd done. He made me promise that I would not join the Nazi Party, and I never did. Of course, that single rash act of picketing Kunstler came back to haunt me many years hence, for it gave my enemies another chance to attack me by association rather than confront the ideas and issues themselves. At the same time, I felt relieved that I had acted publicly. I had crossed my Rubicon, and I felt there was no going back from my chosen path. At Louisiana State University. My father had worked his way through both high school and college. Ultimately, he had a distinguished military career, also successful civilian careers as a petroleum engineer, home builder, and oil man. He later worked for the State Department USAID program in Southeast Asia, and then embarked on a final career position with the U.S. Department of Energy, working into his mid-70s. Father had noticed in his reading that Self-made men seldom seem to have sons as successful. He thought that this occurred because their sons seldom endured the challenges that had brought out the best in their fathers. Even though he certainly had the financial ability to pay my college expenses, he thought it would be better for me to develop the resourcefulness and work habits required by doing it myself. I learned his lessons well, for he taught me that my life's future success or failure was ultimately my own responsibility. In school, I met many students who blamed their parents for all the problems in their own lives. I was thankful mine taught me that I was the ultimate source of how my life would turn out. I believe that a man does not have to simply be affected by outside forces, that he can create the story of his life by simply the power of his own will. A book that really influenced me at the time was The Master Key to Riches by Napoleon Hill. The book really wasn't about money. It was about the real riches of life that can come from accomplishment and believing. I decided to design my life just as someone would write a play or a novel. It does not turn out exactly as planned, but I decided to consciously direct my life rather than just be carried helplessly like a raft on the river of life, but to make my life be like a river, a directed and powerful river of purpose. For me, my own sense of accomplishment could only find meaning in advancing the cause of our people. From the time my father and mother taught me to read, they had emphasized acquiring education. My grandfather, Ernest M. Duke, frequently gave me a little spending money when he came to visit, but father encouraged him to make his gifts for my college savings account. From early grade school, I worked with my father on his home building. In addition, I mowed yards, delivered newspapers, and sold the reptiles I captured in the swamps to the snake farm in Slidell. In high school, I worked some afternoons for Randy Newman at Kohlmeyer & Company, a stock brokerage firm in New Orleans. After my car wreck in my senior year in high school, I no longer had a car and a paper route. I found a tiny, old, and rusted Fiat. I bought it for $200 and brush-painted it military green. The engine was so small, it had a maximum speed of about 70 miles per hour. Beginning in the summer of 1968, I still needed to earn a lot of money for tuition, books, and the price of room and board on campus. I decided to go into business for myself and don my old paint-spattered overalls and painter's cap and drove around my old neighborhood looking for homes with blistering or peeling paint. I'd knock on the door, introduce myself as a college student working his way through school, tell of my experience painting house with my father, and offer to paint the home for about half what a typical commercial firm would cost. I did a competent job, and after I'd done a few houses, word of mouth recommendations kept me busy all summer. It was the hardest summer in my life. I would rise about 5:30 a.m. to be on the job by about 6, and then work until about 8 every evening. Stormy days were my only days off, and I welcomed them. Most of my work was outside, and words seem inadequate to describe the stifling, humid heat of New Orleans during that time. The work that I most hated involved preparing the wooden surfaces. Often I would be high on a ladder, straining and reaching over my head in the heat for hours. Paint dust and chips covering and sticking to my sweat-soaked face and body. Working the underside of eaves was especially difficult. I was 6 feet tall then and still growing, but the all-day intensive work in the New Orleans outdoor summer steam bath left me weighing only about 155 pounds. In the evening, I'd return home and take a long hot shower and then read for about 3 hours until I fell asleep, usually dozing off in the middle of a sentence somewhere. I had little social life at that time. I was simply not up to it. I knew I had to work hard in order to pay for a large portion of the entire college year, and that in only 3 months of work. When I finally left for school in late August 1968, I loaded up my little Fiat and started the 80-mile drive to the LSU campus in Baton Rouge. About three-quarters of the way, I smelled burning rubber and looked in my rearview mirror to see black smoke and flames coming from the rear engine compartment through the cardboard and cloth-covered deck behind the back seat. I pulled over, quickly dumped my gear out of the car, and frantically threw dirt and mud on the engine. But I couldn't stop the flames. By the time I'd snuffed out the flames, my car looked like it had been bombed. A tow truck stopped by, and the driver wanted to know if I needed his services, and I told him that if he wanted the car, he would have it for simply towing it away. I signed the back of my title and watched him tow away my planned transportation for my freshman year. Fortunately, while driving to LSU, an acquaintance saw me, pulled over, and gave me a ride to my dorm room at the North Stadium. I settled into my room later that evening, still smelling of smoke and oil, and quickly made friends with my four new roommates in my five-man room. Not a night from the first one onward seemed to pass without an argument or discussion on the race issue. North Stadium was a wild place in those days, with booze flowing freely, occasional firecrackers going off, and big pot Cajun bourrée card games going on every evening somewhere in the dorm. Loud rock and roll music seemed to permanently play, and occasional fisticuffs added to the excitement. One could become burned out in that dorm, but never bored. Everybody seemed to have an opinion about everything, and no-holds-barred heated discussions took place on everything from religion to politics, from sex to ethics, from space travel to sports. A hierarchy developed among the students, not based on who their parents were or how much money they had, but on how they presented themselves, how fit they were, and how well they kept their word. I became known as the dormitory Klansman, and most of those in my dorm agreed with my basic sentiments, but they were not as committed or vocal about it as I. At least three-quarters of the male students loved the Confederate flag. I soon discovered that a few hated me because of my racial beliefs, but as they got to know me and came to realize that I wasn't a hate monger or a baby killer or a pro-violent person, a number of them became my friends in what was then an all-white dormitory. We could discuss anything in those days, and we did. I think people in that era were far more committed to real freedom of speech and thought than in today's era of political correctness. No subject was off limits. In fact, if a student got his feelings hurt, he was simply viewed as a wuss. Instead of crying to the authorities about politically incorrect insults, you learned how to defend yourself point by point, with repartee, or by your fists, if necessary. Today, on some campuses, uttering politically incorrect sentiments can get a student expelled. Once in a great while, participants could become so agitated or angry that a fistfight broke out. What it seemed, when it was all over, there was a mutual respect for those who had acted like men and not dogs. A college radical. By the time I had finished high school, I knew what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I wanted to become a leader in the cause of our racial survival. I also had some high personal goals. I had attended military school 1 year and looked forward to the ROTC program at Louisiana State University, which had a reputation as one of the best in the country. At that time, ROTC was compulsory at LSU for all freshman male students, but I would have joined anyway, for I wanted to follow in my father's footsteps and spend part of my life as an officer and citizen soldier in the United States Army. Although I had serious doubts about our involvement in a war halfway around the world, I saw communism as an arch enemy that threatened us all. I also knew that its influence had to be curtailed, and since my days as a child in my Gentilly Woods neighborhood, I had wanted to be tested. I looked forward to the challenges of Vietnam, to fighting for my country and the battles I had dreamed about when I was young and innocent. I also joined the Special Forces-oriented extracurricular part of the ROTC program at LSU called the Bengal Raiders, with its rigorous training and special sessions at regular Army facilities. On the academic side, I majored in race. I worked toward a BA in history, but if the curriculum I tailored for myself had been included in the university catalog, it would have been called The Dynamics of Race. During my college career, I took courses in American and European history, one dealing with the Russian Revolution, taught, by the way, by a open Marxist, and two courses centering on the American Revolution. I took biology, geography, and anthropology for a base in the biological aspects of the racial question. I took sociology to better understand the liberal arguments, and I took philosophy, logic, advertising, and speech to understand the underlying philosophic issues and how to express them. I took English and journalism to learn better how to express my beliefs. I took three German classes as a gateway language for European studies. I am also indebted to Willis Carto during this period for his creation. Noontide Press gave me access to many suppressed books that truly completed my education. I often challenged my teachers in class. Many of them taught the egalitarian viewpoint. I had read enough about the topics to dare to debate with them. Most classes at LSU were very discussion-oriented, and I soon developed a reputation for asking impertinent questions and sometimes sharply disputing the teacher's assertions. Instead of just lying low and parroting back what the teachers expected, I wrote dissenting opinions even on some of my essay tests in history, sociology, and other humanities courses, but always carefully backed up my assertions. Most of my professors who disagreed with me still graded me fairly, but I had a few who hated my challenges and graded me down for daring to express a contradictory point of view. Even though I had concern about some teachers knocking down my grades, I found it impossible to remain quiet in class when I heard things that I thought were simply untrue and destructive of our people's well-being. I did not want my fellow students to be misled, and I believed that I had an obligation to speak out. An instance comes to mind. In Philosophy 101, a good portion of the course centered on Sigmund Freud. I like to call him Sigmund Fraud. On one occasion, the professor asked why Freud believed that potty training was so instrumental in the formation of the personality. "Maybe because he had chronic constipation," I quipped, to a good laugh from the class. It incensed me that we were actually taught that anal fixation is a key factor of the personality. At the same time, I had developed good relationships with many of my teachers, including some open-minded, far-left liberals. My German teacher, Professor James Hensey, was extremely liberal, and yet I spent many hours after class in his office in spirited discussion and often friendly debate. Although we sharply disagreed on race, we found common ground in our desire to preserve the environment and reform the corruption inherent in the current political system. During my freshman year at LSU, the Young Americans for Freedom sponsored a speech by Black spokeswoman Julia Brown on the dangers of American communist activity. Brown was a quiet and moving speaker who had remarkable insight into the infiltration of communism into the American government and the mass media. In the question and answer session that followed her speech, I pointed out that most of the communist personalities she mentioned were in fact Jews, and I asked her if she had any thoughts about the fact that Jews were the driving force behind communism historically. She smiled and said that she knew exactly what I was talking about, but she could not get into that. Immediately after the meeting, I met Babs and Virgil Manhinnett. They had rushed up to me and said it was great that I had pointed out the connection between communism and Jews. Babs, her son Tommy, and her husband practically adopted me as part of the family, and I have spent countless hours with them over the years. Babs became a leader in her own right in the cause for our racial survival, and she headed up my campaign for governor in Baton Rouge. I am thankful for her and her family's sacrifice for the cause over the years. She died of cancer in July of 1998, and her spirit shall stay with me as long as I live, and truly with all those that she touched and inspired. I had very little open political activity my first year at LSU. I just kept up my reading and applied myself to my favorite subjects. LSU had an area between the LSU Union and the theater called Free Speech Alley. It came alive every Wednesday at noon. There was a strong anti-war movement at LSU, similar to that at most major universities in the late 1960s, and left-wing activists had dominated Free Speech Alley for years. Although I spoke out in class and had participated in some anti-communist street demonstrations, I had never really given a speech or participated in a formal debate outside the classroom. My nature was always more quiet and personal. It was one thing having a discussion with a few guys in a dorm room, quite another to contemplate giving a speech. Up to my college years, I found my greatest joy in the solitude and silence of the many days I spent in the South Louisiana wilds. I also found that there is quite a difference between reading and speaking. Perhaps the most valuable thing that college did for me was enhance my communication skills. Many well-read, self-educated people have problems when they begin to communicate in an intellectual environment. Sometimes intelligent people are not the best natural communicators. There is a distinct difference between spatial and verbal skills. It is not rare to encounter people who can understand the proofs of the Pythagorean theorem, but who have difficulty speaking fluently. Although well-read, they sometimes mispronounce words that they are familiar with only in the form of the written word. A great thought spoken in bad grammar or with mispronunciation may be more likely to be dismissed in the academic community than a ridiculous thought expressed with eloquence. I also learned the power of humor. I have seen many profoundly illogical concepts effectively promoted by people who were humorous and endearing. The truth also needs those weapons, especially if one is expressing an unfashionable truth. Another lesson I learned from frequent debating is that people are far more convincing when they simply state their beliefs with sincerity. Sincerity and enthusiasm are always more persuasive than cleverness. I discovered in college that racial egalitarians, although scientifically wrong, are often more eloquent than white activists. This is partly because of the powerful social pressures against anyone who speaks out on the race issue. Openness about the truth of race can cost someone his social standing and sometimes even as job advancement and livelihood. The best educated and most accomplished have the most to lose from political incorrectness, and too many remain silent and never take a stand. Many of those who dare to publicly tell the truth about race are from society's lower rungs, people who have relatively less to lose by their outspokenness. They often lack the style to present their arguments well in an intellectual environment. In my second year of college, I resolved to no longer let the anti-war and egalitarian activists dominate the LSU political climate. I started a group called the White Youth Alliance and published a tabloid newspaper called The Racialist, a subtle distinction from the pejorative term racist. Racialist meaning racial idealist. I saw the WYA as a more modern version of the KKK. We use a traditional Klan symbol, the kuklos or cross wheel, which historically has symbolized the sun or enlightenment. On campus, our group would eventually grow to about 300 members, and we were able to start chapters at about a dozen other schools by the time I left college. It grew to a national membership of about 2,000. I resolved to go to Free Speech Alley and speak, determined to tell the truth about racial differences and expose Jewish extremism. Free Speech Alley usually had a few dozen spectators, except when a major student controversy arose. One quiet Wednesday at noon, I stood up on the soapbox and began to tell the whole truth as I knew it. I spoke frankly about racial differences and about the Jewish involvement in communism, as well as the Zionist domination of our government and media. There were only about 15 students present when I started, but after I'd spoken for about 10 minutes, about 300 people had gathered. In 20 more minutes, there were about 1,000. They stood high on the cement planters, while others leaned over the second and third balconies of the Union to get a better view. The longer I spoke, the more easily the words seemed to come together, and the more confident I became. In the uncontrolled atmosphere of the alley, heckling and interruptions punctuated the speeches. Sometimes even projectiles whistled over my head. To win the debate, you not only had to have good arguments, you had to respond to humor with greater humor, and you had to match satire with better satire. My opponents just knew I was wrong in challenging racial equality, but they had difficulty arguing the facts and concepts I presented. The fact that they could not effectively refute my points caused them such frustration that they went to extremes. At one point, attempting to refute my assertions that there were significant genetic differences between blacks and whites, they became so incensed and irrational that they began cutting themselves and holding up their bleeding fingers, black and white. In my book, I have a photograph of their cut fingers, which appeared on the front page of the campus newspaper the next day. All to prove, I suppose, that each race bleeds just as red. I countered that silly argument by telling the crowd that I could go over to the biology laboratory across the street and get any of the lab rats, and that they too would bleed red, just as red. I also told them that they didn't have to cut the rats to prove the rats were as intelligent as they were, for the rats were undoubtedly far superior, as rats would never stupidly cut themselves. Although I preached a supposedly discredited and unpopular doctrine, even most of the liberals reluctantly agreed that I won the debates. Of course, they explained it by suggesting that I was simply a more effective speaker than any of my liberal opponents. They certainly could not give any credit to the logic of my racial heresies. In truth, I had no greater skills than my opponents did. Many of them had stronger speaking voices and more ingratiating styles than I. My secret was having the racial truth on my side, and although the truth certainly does not always win every argument, it is the best weapon. With each passing week, more people began to stand up with me and support my position, until finally, the Reveille, which is the school newspaper, they questioned the entire relevance of Free Speech Alley, saying that it had become simply a forum for racism and suggesting that it should be done away with. No longer a forum for liberalism and Marxist ideology, free speech became expendable. At the end of the 1960s, LSU, like many other colleges, had a strong contingent of communist radicals and some members of the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS. It also had some very radical black students who, at one alley session, frustrated with their loss of a debate with me, picked up my stack of newspapers, The Racialist, and burned them. The incident helped awaken a number of white students at LSU to the realities of race. As my popularity grew among many white students, radical blacks and Jews hated me all the more. Death threats were slipped regularly under the door of my dorm room. One rioter threatened to pour gasoline under my dorm room door as I slept and light it. Bomb threats emptied my dorm on a couple of occasions. During my sophomore year, Dean French called me into his office, concerned for my safety and for the university's reputation and the safety of other students. Students with no family in Baton Rouge were required to live on campus until their senior year. But the dean decided to make an exception in my case. He told me that I could live off campus if I wished. I took a studio apartment on Chimes near Nicholson Drive and did maintenance work for the apartment complex for a reduction of my rent. The apartment manager, whom I knew only as Mr. Friday, Friday, introduced me to Raymond Chandler crime novels and the wonderful writings of Casanova, whom I found to be a tremendous study in human psychology. Mr. Friday became one of my biggest boosters all through college. In my junior year, the Student Government Association invited radical opponents of the Vietnam War, including Dick Gregory and Dr. Benjamin Spock, to speak on campus. My group, the White Youth Alliance, organized protests against each of the featured speakers, and I attended the speeches and challenged them with questions. Before the speeches, I read up on each leftist spokesman, and I was surprised to learn of the many Marxist affiliations of Dr. Spock, the Jewish doctor who wrote the Bible of child care. I also read some critiques of his libertarian anti-discipline style of child rearing, a style that fit in perfectly with the degeneration of the youth of the 1960s. Benjamin Spock delivered an anti-Vietnam War diatribe before a packed Union theater. He alleged that our soldiers were, quote, war criminals in Vietnam. He also sounded traditional Marxist economic themes supportive of equalized incomes for all Americans. He argued that his life was committed to seeing to it that babies he helped raise did not grow up to die in wars or to suffer in poverty. And he also told us that raising taxes and equalizing incomes could permanently end poverty. We could keep babies from dying, he claimed, by refusing to give any assistance to the anti-communist war effort in Vietnam. I made it to the microphone first for his question and answer session. My lengthy question went like this. Dr. Spock, you say you are against the war in Vietnam, not for political reasons, but because you did not want to see the babies you helped raise grow up to be killed in the brutality of war. As you know, the Vietnam War is winding down. Our troops are beginning to come home. There is little you or anyone can do about that conflict now. But there is a new conflict brewing in the Mideast between Israel and her neighbors. There is potential danger for all the world's people in a confrontation of the superpowers in the Mideast. Frankly, I have doubt that your motives are really as you say, simply against the carnage of war. If it is war and the weapons of war you really oppose, would you make a public statement here and now that you also oppose any more American involvement in the Israeli-Arab conflict and that you oppose any more weapons to Israel, just as you oppose armed shipments to South Vietnam? Or, Dr. Spock, is it only war waged against communists that you oppose? Spock was shaken and he stuttered. He mumbled something about the Mideast being an age-old conflict. There were factors, he said, that made the region different from Vietnam. I knew that the paramount difference to him was that Vietnam is Vietnamese and that Israel is Jewish. I got back in line, and right before the question and answer period ended, I asked my second question of the night. By the way, of course, he is a very famous Jewish individual. Here's how it went. Dr. Spock, you've told us tonight of the terrible suffering and hardship of America's poor, especially the Negro poor, and that we need to tremendously raise taxes and eventually have an equalized income for all Americans. Isn't it true, good doctor, that you own an entire island in the Bahamas, that you own a private jet and have a net worth of tens of millions of dollars? If you are so concerned about the poor and believe that the government should forcibly confiscate money and property from hard-working middle-class Americans, my question is, why don't you go ahead and teach us by example and sell your island and your plane and give it to what you call the deserving poor? I challenge here publicly to do voluntarily what you want to force from the rest of us. Will you sell your island and your jet and give the money to the poor? The audience became ominously silent during a long pause, and Spock seemed flustered again by the question. He feebly mumbled that he financially helped causes that he believed in, but the moderator rushed to his rescue. He announced that the program was over, that Spock had to go to the reception. I looked at the dismayed faces of his Marxist followers, and I knew that I'd struck a blow at his hypocrisy. Later that week, in a column in the Reveille, one of its liberal writers wrote that he thought I had asked the best questions of the evening. Although the liberals didn't agree with me, it seemed a lot of respect from them. Although the liberals did not agree with me, I earned a lot of respect from them, and they knew that I was a sincere person with a legitimate point of view. Challenging the icons of the left and spreading the truth of race is exciting and deeply satisfying for me. It is like competing in the Olympics of ideas. Winning these jousts helped wake up my people, and I must confess they were intensely pleasurable on my own personal level. There were aspects of my notoriousness, however, that were not so pleasant. I dated some intelligent and attractive women during the period, and more than once I lost a friend. One teacher publicly ridiculed a girlfriend in class for dating me. Some teachers lowered my grades whenever they had the chance. The threats against my life seemed to grow more serious. Coming from a class one night, four men jumped me and struck a number of hard blows before they ran away into the darkness. Sometimes the media treated me fairly. More often, it did not. In one memorable free speech alley session in which I was hammering at the Jewish hypocrisy of being doves toward the Vietnam War and hawks for Israel, a feminist Jewish anti-war Marxist with hair shorter than mine began screaming obscenities at me at the top of her lungs. "You effing bastard, you son of a bitch, you dot dot dot," she bellowed. Usually, I try to turn such events away with satire or ridicule. I played on her obvious Jewishness by saying, "You are not giving us a good image of a Jewish American princess." At this comment, she began bellowing obscenities even louder. At that, I told her, "You better stop using obscenities or we'll get the idea that you really are Jewish." She then jumped up on the bench and attempted to kick me in the groin. As it was, she kicked me really hard in the shins and on my knees. But I knew that if I punched her out, that tomorrow's headlines would read, "Klansman attacks Jewish girl." So I held her at arm's length, almost like in a cartoon, until the campus security officer who was standing by could get over to drag her off. Of course, she wasn't arrested, but instead of lauding my restraint, the campus newspaper tried to make it look like I wimpishly had to be saved from the diminutive girl. I can imagine what the response would have been if I would have struck this Jewess. It became obvious that once you get on the wrong side of the media, you are doomed to being painted wrong by the press, no matter what you do. At the end of my second year at LSU, I was happy with my progress on all fronts. I had the respect of many liberals, some whom I even called friends. Conservatives liked my outspokenness, while some professors docked my grades, others, even a few of my ideological opponents, spoke well of my classwork and sincerity. Even a couple of the black leaders on campus came to respect my racial honesty, which they had thought was lacking in many whites. They viewed the white race as exploitative and evil, but because they had an honest concern about their own heritage and interests, they could understand my concerns as well. They knew that I was unlike the liberals. I was not trying to subsume the black race and culture under the white. I realized that I could best preserve the integrity of my own race by really fostering the integrity of both. Finding a kindred spirit. In my sophomore year, the White Youth Alliance had a literature table with materials opposing America's pro-Zionist Middle East policy. My friend Ray Lehart watched the table for me while I was in class. A cute co-ed had come by and expressed interest, and he lent her a book. She promised him that she'd call me to return the book after reading it. A couple days later, I heard from her, and we met for dinner to discuss the book. Chloe was strawberry blonde, beautiful, and charming, a pure Southern girl. She could have sparked any man's interest, but even more important to me, she had a natural affinity for my beliefs. She had been a member of the conservative group Young Americans for Freedom on campus. When she read my literature on the race issue, she quickly understood race's vital importance to the conservative values that she cherished. She told me that she readily understood that if the white race was not preserved, neither could conservative principles be saved. I ended up spending the entire rest of the evening with her. We drove around and talked. About 10 p.m., we parked by the largest campus lake, walked out to a moonlit peninsula, and lay back in the cool grass, gazing up at the stars. By midnight, I was telling her my dreams for the future and about the things I so fervently believed. I could see that my words expressed her own feelings and that they burned just as brightly in her own heart. From that night on, we were inseparable. In the next year, she came back very distraught from summer break at home in Florida, for her folks were upset that their daughter would become involved with a radical such as me. It seemed as though we'd lose each other, but after many tears, we decided to continue to see each other. The next summer, I traveled down to West Palm Beach, and although her parents, Jim and Eleanor Hardin, still had a lot of concern about their daughter, they accepted me and realized I was not the monster the media made me out to be. In ROTC, I got along well with the black cadets, and indeed with both the Corps commanders and the teaching staff. After the first year, I had distinguished myself on the drill field and in class. Through the recommendations of both drill and classroom instructors, I won the Outstanding Basic Cadet Award and achieved the highest rank possible in a class of about 3,000 basic cadets at LSU. I mention that fact so that you can understand the greatest disappointment of my college career. At the time I first saw my father in his uniform, I had wanted to serve my country and become a military officer. I look forward to serving honorably in the Vietnam War and actually fighting the communists. I had campaigned so hard against communists here at home, I surely wanted to fight them overseas. I relished every hardship of the Bengal Raiders Special Forces, ROTC training organization. My hopes, though, were about to be crushed. Colonel Joseph Dale, commandant of cadets at LSU, called me in for a meeting. He made the ultimate determination of who would be accepted into the advanced program and thus obtain their officer's commission. Colonel Dale offered me a chair and told me that a number of Jewish people in the community had called him and that they were angered that a member of the ROTC Cadet Corps had expressed what they called, quote, anti-Semitic and racist viewpoints. Colonel Dale said he couldn't give the Corps a bad name and therefore, despite my perfect ROTC record, he could not accept me in the advanced program. He acknowledged that I had not taken my political beliefs into the ROTC classroom or the drill field. His words shocked and hurt me, but I knew that nothing I could say could dissuade him. I reacted by telling him that he was acting unfairly and in an un-American fashion. By your standards, I told him, the first commander-in-chief of the American Armed Forces, George Washington, would have been barred from service. Having to tell my father was the worst part of my rejection. He so looked forward to my being commissioned as an officer as he had. By this time, he had been transferred from Vietnam to Laos, and then a phone call by radio hookup requiring the saying of over and a delay after each statement, I told him of my disappointment. He responded quite kindly to me by telling me that everything always works out for the best in life, if you just believe it to be so. And then he told me that he knew of some ways that I could help the war effort, even though I might not be in the military. He told me that he would try to help me come to Laos and participate in an important program there in support of the war. I hung up the telephone. It was storming outside. Although it was only about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I drew the blinds, turned the air conditioner on high, took off my clothes and got under the covers, where I remained till dawn the next day. The next day, I wrote to Congressman F. Edward Hebert, who my father and I both knew well, and asked him about my military prospects. He told me there was nothing he could do about my commission and suggested that if I tried to qualify for any kind of service, I'd end up getting a, quote, unsuitable for service classification, which would brand me negatively for life. He offered me a student deferment and told me that he always had a lot of respect for me. There are a great many traitors in our government, he told me frankly, and he told me bitterly that he thought traitors in Washington were determined that Vietnam would be the first war that America would lose outright. Your father and I will find a way for you to support the war effort, he promised. I will always remember his last words to me, quote, but David, he said, you must realize that the most important fight for America won't be in Vietnam, but will be right here in our own country, in our own neighborhoods. Frankly, I am in the Washington cesspool of government, and from that vantage point, I can see what's in store for the nation, plain as day. I redoubled my efforts against the Vietnam War Moratorium Committee at LSU and was determined that until I went to Southeast Asia, I would do my best to oppose those at home who were stabbing our soldiers in the back. The war in Vietnam was entering a critical phase as the 1970s began, and I wanted to do whatever I could to help the fight against communism. It seemed obvious that even after the sacrifice of tens of thousands of American lives, Kissinger and Nixon planned to abandon Southeast Asia to the communists. My father was with the USAID program in Laos, where he helped the anti-communist government with public works programs. He contacted the U.S. State Department and run school in Vientiane for Laotian military officers. It had to be ostensibly run as a civilian operation because Laos, although anti-communist, was officially neutral in the war. The anti-communist Royal Laotian forces controlled only about 20% of the nation, while the Pathet Lao, the communist forces, controlled the remainder. But the anti-communist forces controlled the major cities of Vientiane, which was the administrative capital, and Luang Prabang, the rural capital. The U.S. government surreptitiously supported the anti-communists. The school needed instructors in Vientiane at the American Language School, where Laotian army officers and air force officers were trained and instructed in basic and military-oriented English. It was a basic program that enabled them to be further instructed by actual American military advisors in the field or at American bases in Southeast Asia or in America. My departure for Asia inspired mixed emotions. I reflected on how behind-the-scenes Jewish pressure had prevented me, a patriotic American, from gaining my deserved placement in the advanced ROTC program, and ultimately the military service that I looked forward to since I was a little boy in awe of my father's uniform. It was a bitter but instructive lesson. But in the end, my resolve was that I would never surrender to the efforts of our enemies to intimidate me into submission. I stiffened my determination to fight even harder for my beliefs, my people, and my nation. As has always occurred in my life, every setback ultimately made me stronger inside. I viewed every hardship as sharpening my will. I knew that to forge a strong character and will, that I had to suffer sometimes the furnace of hardship and disappointment. With my job secured, my father arranged for my passage as his dependent to Laos. I packed my trunk with a number of books I'd ordered from Willis Cardo's Noontide Press. I looked forward to my sojourn overseas and wondered what adventures lay ahead. Next chapter is chapter 30, Around the World.